Today is, what the heck is today? It's July, don't tell me, July 19th, 2011. This is the first interview with Hillary. And Hillary, how do you pronounce your last name?
I usually pronounce it American-wise, Virtanen.
Virtanen?
Yeah.
Okay. What would be the
Finnish, Virtanen.
Virtanen?
Yeah.
This interview is being done for what we're loosely calling our Capitol protest 2011 Oral History Project. My name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. So, Hillary, thank you for walking across the mall and meeting me up here. And fortunately, this room actually doesn't feel too bad. For the record, we're suffering through a little bit of heat index here in Madison, and we're also suffering through a bit of heat index inside the buildings on campus. And we picked one that actually feels like it's almost normal. Hillary, before we get to the meat of this, I want to ask a couple of background questions.
Okay.
I think it's important to get a context of a person's life, regardless of what topic we're interviewing them about. So this is my brief biography question. So
okay.
If you don't mind, and you can take as much or as little time as you want to bring us up to speed in your life from some of your earliest memories until you ended up coming here.
Okay. Well, I was born in April 1978 in Hancock, Michigan, to a family from a town called Tuivalu, Michigan, which is pretty much 100% Finnish ethnically. I grew up a lot in Wyoming and also in places including Colorado, South Dakota, New Hampshire, a little bit in Montana, a tiny bit in Ohio, and then I've also lived in Missouri and Indiana for grad school. I graduated from high school in Michigan in 1976, up in Upper Michigan, in Painesdale. And I went to Michigan State University for my bachelor's degree in English and Anthropology, and I got that in 2003. I went to Indiana University and got a master's in folklore, which I got in 2006. And then I came up here in 2006 to continue studying, and I got a master's in Scandinavian Studies in 2008. And then I've been working on my PhD in folklore here ever since. So I've been married since 2006, but my husband and I have been together since 1998, and we have three kids. We have a 10-year-old named Alex, a 9-year-old named Audrey, and a 4-year-old named Annalie. And he's originally from the Detroit area, so.
Okay. Mm-hmm. A couple of things. First, you said that the town is Tuivalu?
It's T-O-I-V-O-L-A. That means place of hope in Finnish. But the suburb of Tuivalu, where I'm from, is called Misery Bay.
Which I don't think translates to place of hope.
No. It's the end of the line.
If you don't mind me asking, you grew up in a lot of different places.
Mm-hmm.
What caused all the moves?
I think adults looking for jobs. Mostly. My family moved to Wyoming in about 1979 or 80 because my dad got a job in the oil fields in northern Wyoming. And then my mom went to college in southern Wyoming for quite a while, too, in the early to mid-80s. And so we lived there for a while, and then we just kind of moved around where she got jobs after that. So.
Okay. And what did your mother do?
After she graduated, she mostly worked as a teacher.
Okay.
But she was also a state employee in Michigan for a while, and
What was your BA in?
It was in English and Anthropology.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then your MA in Indiana?
Mm-hmm. Was folklore.
Okay, so folklore and then Scandinavian Studies in folklore. So maybe I'll start there. How did you get an interest in folklore?
I think it had a lot to do with the fact that I did live in a lot of different places when I was younger, and I would always wind up in these really interesting communities where there were people of a lot of different ethnicities. And like when I lived in Laramie, Wyoming, it was one of the few towns in Wyoming where you would get people from all around the world who lived there because of the university. And so I had friends who were from places like Egypt and Iraq and Korea and just all over. And every time we would leave the places where we lived and go home and visit up in the UP, it was just this town full of Finnish people, you know, and so you would always be doing you know, I mean, the UP is really known for having this really interesting inter-ethnic culture up there. And so I always just really noticed how different it was to be up there and the different traditions that we had and the Finnish words that we used that people that weren't from around there had no idea what they were. And so I think I've always just kind of known that cultures of both my own community and the communities that I've lived in were really interesting. And, you know, it showed a way to, like, break into different communities by learning a little bit about their norms and their traditions and customs in order to kind of fit in really quick. So,
why did you end up going from Michigan State to Indiana?
Well, I hadn't heard of a folklore major. I didn't know what it was. And when I was getting done with my time at Michigan State, I'd wanted to go. I was really interested in medieval literature, like Chaucer and stuff. And then I was also really interested in doing fieldwork-based research, like anthropology. And I kept trying to push the two together. And all these professors were saying, there's no such thing as the anthropology of literature. There is, however, this thing called folklore that you might be interested in. And at first I thought they meant like folklore, like BS, you know. And so then someone was like, no, really, there's a folklore program at Indiana that I know of. You should check it out. So I just immediately grabbed an application, sent it in, you know, a couple of days before it was due. And they thought that I was related to a really famous Finnish folklorist named Leah Virtanen. So they were like, oh, totally, rubber stamp. So, yeah. Thanks, Virtanen. It's the most common name in Finland, or it's the second most now.
So why, while at IU, what did you study within folklore?
I studied Finnish traditions and Finnish American traditions. So for my master's thesis, I did an online exhibit that's actually online here at UW about this folklore character that was invented in Upper Michigan in the 70s called Heikki Lunta, which actually translates to Hank Snow, who's a famous country singer from the, you know, 60s and 70s. But it was this sort of character that was created to kind of reflect on the way that tourism was changing the area and the way that local people get treated really shabbily by tourists a lot of the time when they come. But they depend on tourism as this industry. And so Heikki Lunta was sort of this way to negotiate the really poor social interactions that were happening because of tourism with the fact that, you know, they need the money and they need to have control over the way tourists are going to come and approach the area. So it was a sort of way of saying, no, we're in charge. We're going to turn off the snow. So
what type of field work did you do for that?
I lived in Upper Michigan for 2 summers with my family, and we rented a cabin behind a bar in Keweenaw County. And so I worked at the bar part-time, and then I also had an internship at the Finnish American Heritage Center, where I'm about to start working now. And I also taught ESL at Michigan Tech. So I had to do a lot of work in order to support myself. I also picked berries and sold them to a couple of different jam makers up there. So that was the financial side of getting my field work done. And then the other side was I just lived there, and people would come tell me their stories. Like, they literally would show up at my doorstep and be like, I have a dog named Heikki Lunta. Here's his picture. Stuff like that, so...
It sounds like it was a good thing they showed up at your door.
Yeah.
You were working
at the bar. Yeah. Well, that's a good place to get stories as a bartender, so.
So why matriculate here at UW?
Well, it's kind of a political issue. I have problems with elitism in the academy, and I felt that it was very strong at Indiana. They are ranked the top folklore program in the world. So you can see where they would be like, we rock, we're awesome. But they have a real problem with people who want to work in the public sector in folklore, which is something that I do want to do. And they also would take students in without giving you a real picture of what financial aid would be like there. And then, I mean, sometimes you'd get this idea that you were going to get funding and then you didn't. And that happened to me 1 year where I funded myself. And so the third year that I was there, I actually did get an assistantship, but by that time I'd actually met some people from UW here when I was at a Finnish Heritage Festival in Marquette where I gave a paper on Heikki Lunta, and 2 different people from the program here came up to me within about an hour of each other and were like, I've been following your work, I've heard about you, you know, I think it's really interesting what you're doing, I'd love to talk. And that was at the same time where I was seriously considering just dropping out of grad school and doing something else. And so I was like, you guys are all from the same university. And so I checked it out and researched it a little more, and I was like, it sounds like that's the place I should be, because UW has a really strong public sector approach. And most of the people who teach in the UW program have at least a little bit of experience, if not a vast amount of experience, in public folklore.
Who were the people who approached you?
Jim Leary, he's usually the program director. This year he's not because he's in charge of something else. But and then there was a student named Tim Frandy, who's a PhD student here.
Frandy's on our list to be interviewed.
Oh, yeah. And one of the main things, too, that attracted me was the fact that at IU, the graduate students aren't allowed to unionize. And they had a really horrible governor who was elected during the last year I was there. And Mitch Daniels, not my man, Mitch. And so when I heard that they were unionized here, I just thought, that's really exciting. That's really, you know, interesting and cool. Because I know that my mom has been a part of a union in the state of Michigan before, even though she never talked about it. But I just thought that would be really good for me to kind of have this role in saying how my conditions of work would be and stuff. And especially with the really poor wages at IU. I mean, their health insurance for grad students wasn't even affordable. So
in the last few minutes, you've talked about problem with elitism in academy and IU not graduate students not being able to unionize. I can assume from this where you stand on the political spectrum, but I wonder if you want to talk about, or I'll ask it this way, where did these ideas in you or these feelings, or did they arise while you were at IU, or were these attitudes and opinions that you had then sort of crystallized at IU?
I should back up and say that my family, my Finnish family, one of the most famous people in my sort of lineage is my great-great-grandpa, Enoki Wiedemann, which I can spell for you later. But he has a reputation, even though he died in 1928, of being the great communist in our family. So, you know, Finnish people are kind of known for having that radicality when they came to America. And I think that even though my family never really talked about it, you know, I grew up during the Cold War, during the end of the Cold War. And I remembered always just people talking about Reagan and Gorbachev and their nukes. And I always just thought, what's the big deal if Russia wants to have their own system like that? You know, what's the big deal if we have our own system our own way? You know, why not just leave each other alone? And I've always felt that, you know, as I kind of grew up and started understanding more and more about how Reaganomics was negatively affecting my family and the families that I knew, I just became very, 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 very left-wing. From an American standpoint, I'm sure I'm very centrist or right-wing compared to other countries, but so, I mean, I've always had that there, where I've always thought that, like, people from the working class and the poverty class were getting a really, really, really raw deal in this country. And, you know, when you grow up, they tell you, oh, you're in America, you can be whatever it is you want. And so, even though I was born in the poverty level, I've worked my butt off since the age of 5 to get to be where I am now. And I'm just about to take my dream job. So, you know, it's still possible, but there's a lot of obstacles to my getting here. So, I just feel like there's always this kind of system that people overlook or ignore, act like it doesn't really exist, that really makes it hard for poor people to actually get ahead and get to do what they want. And so, I mean, with the idea of unions, like, I hadn't really thought of there being union jobs for graduate students. You know, when I applied to IU, I just thought it was great that I got a fellowship my first year. And then the second year, I thought it was great that I found another little job. And then after that, you know, just piecing together the money. But then when I started thinking about going to UW and I found out about how their system for graduate employees worked, I just thought, that's really great. You know, it gives people a deeper commitment to what it is they're doing, and it makes them more involved in the community and stuff. So, I mean, it sort of became a way for me to be able to practice the things that I thought were interesting, you know, because I never had that opportunity before. You know, waitresses and Little Caesars restaurant managers don't get unionizing opportunities, but here it was already embedded. It was there.
Thank you. So when you came to UW, and it was it the fall of 2006?
Uh-huh, yep.
Okay. Do you recall, I mean, you know, it's all so long ago, a little under five years, I guess, what were your goals, what were your visions coming here? What did you want to do when you came here?
Well, what I wanted to do was, I wanted to be a part of this really great faculty and group of students that were all working on the same thing. And that's one of the things that I think is so great about UW, is that, at least in my programs, they really do a good job of mentoring students, and they really do a good job of giving students these kind of side opportunities. Like, they look for internships that we could apply for, or they look for different jobs and stuff. I've done contract work doing things like I transcribed some tapes for the DNR for a book that they published through the Historical Society Press about sturgeon fishing. I got to proofread a book that a Swedish graduate student had written for her dissertation, and she was translating it into English so it could be published in English. And so I got to read that translation and kind of help her make it more smooth for English language readers. And, you know, there's just been a lot of opportunities like that. And so I thought that it would be great to be here to get a study, to have this kind of academic life that was a lot more holistic than it really was for me at Indiana. And I was extremely involved at Indiana. I was a student, I was the president of two student organizations. If I said I wanted to do something, you know, I brought speakers from Canada to come over. I mean, I did stuff like that. But here, there was a lot more encouragement to do that kind of stuff. And there was a lot more of people saying, yeah, we'll all do this together. So, and that's the same thing with the union. I mean, when I had first started, I had really hoped to become actively involved in the leadership of the union. But when we first moved here, we lived in Stoughton, which is, you know, it was about 15 miles out of town, but that's actually a 45-minute commute because we lived in the back roads and had to drop off kids at the daycares and the school first. And then I found out I was pregnant, and so I was sick also for the, you know, second 6 months that I was here. And so it just made it hard for me to become as active in the union as I had wanted to after that. And especially with, you know, I mean, the one trade-off for living in Madison between living in Bloomington, Indiana, is that it's a lot more expensive here. And so when we moved from Stoughton to Madison to make life a little easier the next year, we actually had to take on extra jobs just to keep living here. So, and to, you know, to live in the comfort that we wanted. Because, I mean, we could have lived in student housing or something, but I did that when I was a kid, and I'm an isolationist at heart. Even though I like unions and, you know, people working together, when I go home at the end of the day, I don't want to know I have neighbors, so. Weird circle tour.
Okay, as I said before, for this session, I have up until 1 o'clock or just a little bit before, so there's lots of interesting stuff you said that I'd like to probe, but I think we probably should get into the meat of it now. And,
okay.
So I'll start by this, and you sort of answered this, but again, I'll ask it directly. So would you consider yourself to be involved or active in politics before February 2011?
I'd say so, yeah. When I was younger, I wasn't so much, just because, I mean, the first year that I was able to vote, Bill Clinton was very clearly going to be the next president again. So, you know, I didn't feel terribly worried about running out and marching or anything like that. And there wasn't, at the time, too, I was living in Michigan, and there wasn't going to be a governor election that year. We were still stuck with the horrible John Engler. So, you know, I mean, I've always been politically active and politically interested. I mean, I try to keep up on news and stuff like that and to know what's going on, but it didn't feel as threatening to me as, you know, after George Bush was elected and after he took office in 2001 was really when I was just like, I'm going to vote at every single election. You know, like back in the day, I would be like, it's a primary. I'm not going to worry about it. Or, they're just voting for a judge. But then when George Bush came in, I started trying to make sure that I was getting to more and more of the elections, you know. And then since coming here, I actually have made a point of going to all the primaries and stuff like that. So.
So was it after the 2000 election, or was it during the 2000 election that you sort of see this pivot?
Well, it was definitely before. I mean, if I'd have been able to vote during Reagan's time. Oh, if I could take back my first grade vote when everybody in Wyoming was voting for Reagan and they had the class vote and we're all like, Reagan, totally, our mom and dad said he's great, I would not have voted for Reagan. But, but you know, I mean, ever since George Bush, like, I really just thought, oh, my God, this country's just going to flop over. And so, yeah, I mean, I would say, like, at the time of his election, when Gore lost by such a weird, weird set of circumstances, you know, I was just like, all right, militant vigilance, I guess. Not militant, but very, very deep vigilance.
This is a very open-ended question, so choose to take it wherever you want, and then I'll sort of follow up and probe.
Okay.
But, so here it is. Describe your involvement in the protests in and around the Capitol in the winter spring of 2011.
Okay. Well, on February 11th, I was at work at the Wisconsin Historical Society, and that was the Friday before the protests. And the TAA had already organized the I Love IU, Don't Break My Heart, Governor Walker event, where we were all going to go down with the Valentine cards on February 14th, you know, the following Monday. So February 11th, I'm in my office at the Historical Society, and I went to go check my email there. And I noticed an email from Scott Walker in my inbox, and I was just like, you know, because I was already very, very deeply unhappy that he'd been elected. So I opened up the email, which was the one that said that, you know, I'm cutting contracts on this date. I think it was March 13th that he said that all the contracts would be null and void if they hadn't been given an end date. And so, and that left us in the lurch as a TA member. And, you know, I was also leaving all my coworkers at the Historical Society in the lurch. And I should explain that at that time when I was working, I had a graduate assistantship, which is TA represented at the UW. I had my LTE job at the Historical Society, which I still have. And that's, you know, 20 hours a week. I had been put into the retirement system program, and I could have gotten health insurance if I didn't already have it through UW. But, and then I also had an hourly graduate student job, which was also governed by TA contracts. And since our contract wasn't approved by the legislature in December, we were left high and dry, and, you know, officially our contract was supposed to die on March 13th. So when I got that email, I just remember being so furious about it and just being like, well, I said a couple of swear words, and then I got up from my desk and I walked out into the hall, and I noticed a couple other people talking about it too. And somebody had actually taken that email and posted it to the little board we have in the inner area where we work. And so I was just so mad. I just looked at that email for another minute, and then I wrote across it, well, I'll see you in the rotunda. And then, you know, then I left. I had to leave for the day. So that Monday, well, actually that night, I got a call from Tim, saying that, it was either a call or an email, but saying that that they had actually gotten letters sent to the people who are presidents of the different unions around, and that it was a letter from the guy who runs OSER saying that, you know, your contracts will be null and void as of this date unless you guys had them provided for after that date. And so he emailed it to me, and he was just like he's very active in the TA, and they were gonna get together and do their thing, and, you know, get together and meet and talk about what they're gonna do. And I have to go home after work every day because I've got my three kids, and because my husband's been very sick this past year, and so, you know, we've been having kind of a harder time getting out and about and stuff. And so I went home, and then he called and said, well, we've got this email that we got from OSER. And so I went and looked at the email, and it was saying pretty much the same thing that the email had said, but a lot more kind of directly, and it just really infuriated me. And so at that point, I decided to make a Facebook page, or a Facebook event, actually. And it ended up having the longest name in history. It's called the Virtual Wisconsin State Employees Unions Solidarity Vigil. And I wanted it to be a point where people could post information and stuff, because everything was happening so fast on the ground. And I didn't really know how long it would last. I planned the vigil for, like, you know, through the middle of the following week or so. And then I had to keep extending the date, and I would add information. Like, I did send copies of that PDF, or the OSER letter that we had gotten, and I sent a PDF of the email I had gotten, and then just information about the Don't Break My Heart rally that we were going to have, and just things like that as they came up. And people really took to that page. By the time the event ended, there was over 18,000 people who said they were attending it, and there were people from around the world, and I just... The page was up for probably about 2 weeks, or the event was up for about 2 weeks. And at that point, when I realized that the event was going to go down on the Facebook, I had to set up a page. And so I did that with the same name and called it the page after that. And so a lot of the people, well, I don't have 18,000 people on it now. I have about 1,600 people on it that follow it, but they're also from around the world, even though a lot of people from the upper Midwest. And so we just started posting stuff. And then on that Monday, on February 14th, when the Valentine's Day rally was going to happen, we went down, and I was just so upset still. Like, when I got out of my car that Friday night, when I had first gotten the email from Scott Walker, my husband comes out of the garage, and I was just like, do you know what that bleepity bleep bleeping governor of ours just did? And I, like, held out the letter that I printed off, and he was like, what is this? And I was just like, he just killed our union. He's going to kill our union. You know? And he was just like, calm down, Hillary, because he knows I can get very angry about politics, and I'll just be like, rawr, for a little bit. So that Monday I went to the rally, and before I went, I made a little sign that said, Scott Walker, boo hiss, because I was just so furious. And I stood outside the bus stop holding it up. And I held it up before I went that whole day, like, just walking, got off the bus, held it up. I held it against the window the whole time I rode on the bus so people could see it. I was just like, he will know my dissent. So I went to the rally, and it was just... it was really nice. It was really exciting because we met outside the Memorial Union and there was just so many people. And we, some of them were my friends and some of them weren't. And, you know, just so many people. And one of the guys from the TA handed me a little stack of things, like little flyers to give to people that said to contact their legislator and let them know what they thought about this so-called budget repair bill. And so I was passing those out too. And then we marched up and it was just so, like, I've been to the Capitol a bunch of times. You know, I've been to the Capitol for the time when, I think in 2007 when they were having the budget issue when it wasn't going to get passed. And so all the union people went down and all those, the Tea Party group went down and, you know, we all just kind of lined up and we're like, hey, we're here, please do this budget thing already. And, but it was the first time I ever went to the Capitol with just this whole horde of people and we're all just like, this is it, we've had enough. And it just felt so awesome. I mean, when you spend your whole life thinking that the government isn't really working in your favor and that, you know, is anybody else paying attention to this? Does anybody else seem to notice? It was just really kind of gratifying to be like, wow, they really do. So, so that was the first day, you know, we went down and we did our march and I got a little camera, a little video camera from the folklore program that I checked out and took a little videos of it. And they were kind of cheesy because all you could hear was a bunch of people screaming, but mostly me. And like I can get my voice very loud. Like I'm very, very good at being excessively loud. And so I was just like, rah! And the next day I went back to the rallies again and met up with a couple of my friends there. And I mean, I just couldn't believe how many people were there. And I was terrified. Like when we first went, I was just like, you know, we could get arrested or something. Like, I don't know how this is going to go because Scott Walker had that thing about how he was going to enforce things with the National Guard. And I didn't know what I was walking into, but I certainly wasn't going to stay home for it. So I told my husband when I left, I was like, you know, I don't know how this is going to turn out. I left my daughter home that day, my 4-year-old from daycare, just in case I got arrested because I'm the one who has to pick her up at 6 every night. And then I checked the bank accounts to see which one. And I was like, I don't know if the AFL-CIO would bail me out if anything even happens. So if they don't, you know, here's the debit card. This is the one to use. Bail me out. And so I managed to make it home later that night. And it was really weird those first few days because we had that first week of the protests. And after that night, I stopped sending my kids to school because I didn't know if the teachers were going to be there or not. But I didn't think my kids should go to school under the circumstances, and I thought that they should go with me. And so they did. And it was just so exciting to just be around so many people and to show them, you know, these are people who all feel the same way that we do. And these are also people who will be affected as much, more, less than us, but they're all here to say, hey, this isn't right. And so my middle daughter was really, 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 really good. I mean, she just loved it. She was picking up signs, like, you know, people had to leave their signs on posts outside the doors, and so she'd go grab a sign and just, like, march off with it for a while, and she would all be shouting and just, you know. It was really exciting for that. But then one of the problems that we had when people first started setting up, like, the TAA's room that they had set up in there and stuff was getting information, because it was really easy for rumors to spread with all those people in there, and sometimes with things like the internet getting cut off and stuff, or, like, certain websites not getting access to the internet feed. And so, people were kind of getting weird sometimes. And so it was kind of nice to have my kids with me in that, and also to have to go home and take care of my husband a bit, because I could go home and see what was going on in the news and see what was going on out in the world and, you know, get information from people who weren't there but were keeping an eye on what was going on. So I thought that it was really important, because it could have been really easy during that first little bit to have something bad happen because of, like, rumors or, you know, anything really. And I was really, really happy when it didn't. So that first week when I got home, like, I was always amazed that I got home, first of all, and, you know, that no National Guard members had shown up or anything. And I was really impressed by the way that the community just took off, because the night when they had the Joint Finance Committee hearings on February 15th, I actually testified before them. And so that first day when I went, I was there all day. And then I ended up wheedling my way into that room because I had gotten on the list very early, but it took so long for the testimony. And so I was just like, well, I'm just going to stay in here until I can testify because I have to go home. And so they finally got to me at about like 6:30 or something, and I gave my testimony. And that was a whirlwind. Like, they only give you 2 minutes, but I took 5. I just wouldn't leave. And when I went home, you know, I told my husband what had happened. And I actually got a couple of nice emails from people who saw it, like, on the web or whatever, you know, but if, like from some guy from Superior or something was like, I was really touched by what you said. And then there was a guy at work who said he thought that I might have helped the LTEs keep their health insurance benefits because they were one of the groups who's going to lose it. So, but we didn't, of course. And the very next day, my kids and I were out there marching, and we see Randy Hopper outside. And this is totally before the whole mistress, and I live in Madison, but I represent Fond du Lac thing came out. And so I saw him, and like I'd been sitting there for like 6 hours looking at the names of all these people I was going to testify before. And so I saw him, and I was like, oh my God, that was one of the senators I saw. And I'm thinking in my head, who is that? Who is that? And I was like, Randy Hopper. And so I was like, Senator Hopper. And he turns around, and you know, like, he's probably used to going around Madison at that point without anybody except for his own constituents who don't live in Madison knowing who he is. So he saw me, and he's all like, hi. And he sees me, like, me and all three of my kids, we all have our protest signs up. And we're all just like, and I was like, I really hope that you and your colleagues take to heart what we all told you yesterday, all of us. And he was just like, yeah, thank you for coming. And he's kind of like sidewinding over toward one of the little side doors in the Capitol. And so I'm looking at him like, we have this perfect opportunity. There's a shitload of people behind us. And so I start chanting, do the right thing, Hopper, do the right thing. And my kids join in. And so like the dude just bursts out into a run and like goes busting in the Capitol. And we're all still like, do the right thing. And there's this group of people, a couple people behind us saw what was happening. And so they started chanting with us. But then there was little people further off from them. And like, you know, I was just laughing. And I was like, you kids are awesome. And, you know, we turned around to walk away. And some guys were like, what was that all about? And I was like, Senator Randy Hopper of Fond du Lac, ladies and gentlemen. And I mean, and all you see is you know, boots running into the door. So yeah, that was really funny. But I spent a lot of time up there the first few weeks. I mean, I had to go home every night again, so I didn't spend a night in the Capitol. But I would go and check on things and see if there was any kind of help I could do at the TAA. I would go and talk to people like Tim or to Claiborne, who's one of the staff members at the TAA, and just see if there's anything I can do. And there was one time it was really fun, right? I'd noticed that there was just a bunch of kids in the Capitol. And so I got a box full of just toys and like some crayons and a couple coloring books and some books and just things to do. And I put it in the area where the TAA was. And Claiborne had a bunch of meetings that day, and she has five kids, but four of them are, you know, kid age still. And so they were kind of bored and tired, and it was really loud in there. And so we actually were able to go take a room in Christine Sinicky's office. She's an assembly member from Milwaukee. And so I got to take the kids down there for the day. And it was nice because there was like a vestibule with doors. And so it was totally closed in, you know, before you got to the office rooms. And so in that vestibule, the kids actually had space to play and run around, and it wasn't so loud. And, you know, it was off the beaten path. And that was the day of the first Tea Party rally, which was set. 300 Tea Partiers or something with the gajillions of us. So we actually had a good view of the rally from right there too. So we could sit in the office and just kind of watch like the three guys with the sign. And so that was fun. And then, you know, for a while I couldn't go to the Capitol very much at all. And so I think I was gone for like 5 days after that. And then I was really surprised and really happy to see that whole family area had opened up. Because Claiborne and I had actually talked about that. We were talking about having a, you know, Capitol, we're going to have like a Capitol kids school or something, you know, Capitol Elementary was our joke, and that we're going to have little parades for the kids every day, and we're going to just do activities with them and stuff and let the parents kind of take a break or whatever. So it was really nice to see that somebody else had set that up then when I was gone. And I was still doing the page. I mean, today when I do the page, it takes me about 2-3 hours a day, which is a lot. But back then, like, I would be on the page for 6 hours a day, busted up into chunks, you know, between being at the rallies and being, you know, having to stop by work so I wouldn't lose my job. And I mean, we thought, too, I thought a strike was going to be called for sure. I actually hoped a strike was going to be called just because it's one of the ways to get stuff done. And so I spent a lot of time when I wasn't either at work or on the page, or, I mean, when I wasn't, you know, working on the page, or at the Capitol itself, or taking care of stuff at home so my family still had clean socks, I would actually be getting a bunch of work done at the Journal of American Folklore, where my union job was, just to make sure that the journal didn't suffer. And I actually wrote a letter to this public folklore listserv that they have online, explaining what was going on and why, you know, why it is you're seeing these big pictures of the people in the rotunda is because of this. And the entire TAA is a union shop, because at that point the UW faculty had actually gotten the right to join, to have their own union too. And so not only me, but the editors were both members of the American Federation of Teachers, you know, so. And also before, like right after Scott Walker got put into office, that was one of the things I did, was I put a sign on my door that said, this office is a union shop, and it had the TA logo. Like, I made it myself, and it was just like, you know, I'm not an idiot. Like, I could totally tell what Scott Walker was going to do as soon as he got into office, even though he didn't campaign on it. Like, he tells everybody. So I had put that sign up and just been like, it's a union shop. And even when you say it's not, I'll still pay my dues to them. So.
Do you mind if I jump in here?
Yeah.
I'm going to start from the back to the front. This isn't my interview. I have my opinions on this. But what you just mentioned is something that I've thought of, too, is that I think you had to be a bit naive to think that this something like this wasn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I know why I felt that way. Why did you feel that way?
Well, I'm one of those people who, like, I have a really, really hot temper. And so my natural response to something like this would be to do something like this. You know, I mean, like, even if nobody else would be interested in doing it, I'll still bitch and moan about stuff for a while and be like, those assholes, this is my personal protest right now. You know, and so I thought that I was really, really surprised at how many people showed up, and not only from around the state. Like, I mean, the day that the Joint Finance Committee did their testimony, or the day after that, I remember seeing a guy from Superior, Wisconsin, holding up a sign. And I was just like, Superior, Wisconsin, wow! You know, and so I just think that so many people, the reason why it was stupid of him to expect this was, I mean, first of all, it was really dumb for Scott Walker to think that he could say something about the National Guard and think we'd all be cowed into it, because that's not his personal army. You know, he doesn't have the right to be like, oh, well, I'm just going to use these guys to do this and that. And, you know, and I mean, it's just like, like, you really thought that we were going to be cowed into not doing anything. And then also just the fact that Madison does have this really progressive history, and that there's so many people in Madison. I mean, you know, he might have gotten away with this if he had a town like, you know, 50,000 people or something small. But I mean, we have, you know, I don't know how many people in Dane County, but Madison, over 200,000 people. A lot of those people are union members. A lot of those people are right here. A lot of those people have vacation days they're allowed to spend. I mean, yeah, of course we're going to be there. So, yeah, I mean, I really think he underestimated the response he was going to get, and especially within a town that has such a strong union tradition, and in a state that has such a strong progressive tradition. You know, it was just dumb.
Let me come back here. The idea of information. In Idaho, I interviewed forest firefighters and smoke jumpers, and I asked them about communication, and they said that there was too much information, a bad thing, and they said, well, yeah, I mean, but you can never have too much good information.
Right.
And how did you, or how did the TAA try to, or if you did, try to sort of keep these lines of communication? What's happening that's actually happening,
mm-hmm.
and what's being said that has been through either a game of telephone or through the rumor mill has been blown up into something it isn't. How did
right.
you, either specifically or as a TAA, did you try to keep good communication going?
Well, I mean, the first thing, like I said before, was just to make sure to go someplace that wasn't the Capitol for a while every day. I mean, first of all, just to kind of get my head together, because it was so loud there. And I mean, a lot of the time, a lot of the time I felt like I was at a powwow, which I've been to a lot of powwows, and I really enjoyed that. And, you know, just being in some sort of event where you're with a bunch of people that you share the same interest and something really just amazing and exciting is going on, you know, I mean, that can really get to your head. And so it was really important to kind of step away from that every day. And just, I always made sure every day to read what it was that newspapers in and outside the area were saying. I also would just try to kind of keep an eye on what the rumor things were. Because I remember at one point, like, people were kind of being told that different things, like, I can't remember what exactly it was now, but, like, they were being told different things, like, oh, you got to run over here very quickly because something's about to happen, or, you know. And it was just like, well, we should stop and check out who said that and what it is, you know. And I think, like, that's one of the things that all along with the thing on the Facebook that I do is, to try to kind of know who it is that's saying it. And so a lot of times, like if somebody has something, for instance, in their status line, I'll copy the name of that person too, just to kind of keep an idea of who it is. And I mean, and I don't think that's bad, you know, if they already did it and they're putting that on their name, then it's fair for me to say, this group over here said this, you know. And to just have a variety of ideas. Because I mean, that's one of the other things is, when this was all going on, like there were all these different ideas how to handle it. And I remember I had a couple of friends from Upper Michigan come down and visit, and they stayed the night, one of the last nights that people could stay in the Capitol. And there was these people who had come all the way from Seattle area, and they were very much like, the cops are our enemies and blah, blah, blah. And I just felt like they're not acting like our enemies here. And I really think that even if something happens, we need to help separate that idea that, you know, this is their job, from the fact that they are union members and in principle they are supporting us, you know. And there were times when, like, I was really angry at the police for doing things like not letting Joe Parisi in on the day that they, the day after they did the illegal vote, because Joe Parisi was my assembly representative. And I, he was outside the Capitol, he was locked out, him and Jesse Jackson were there, and like they couldn't get in. And so, you know, we followed around the building, we're trying to make some noise and get some police to open the doors, and they just wouldn't. And Joe Parisi was standing on the steps of the Capitol, I think at the King Street entrance, saying, you know, they're not letting me in right now. I'm not able to represent my constituents properly. And I was standing right next to a state cop, and I was like, what is wrong with you guys? This dude is our assembly member. I can Google it right now for you and show you his picture. It's the same guy. And they wouldn't even respond. Like, they wouldn't say anything. But I mean, that was their job. Someone told them to do that, you know. And so, yeah, I mean, it was, I mean, part of it was just to kind of know that there's going to be all these different approaches to the way the people are going to handle this situation. And to also know that it's worth it, even if you disagree with it, to sort of talk about it anyway. And so with regards to like information and figuring out that I know like what's going on and kind of keeping those lines of communication, I mean, I would accept ideas from anyone. I would kick people off the page if they were trolls and stuff. And I would, you know, if somebody from the TA or somebody said, you know, this is something that's going on with us right now, you know, I would totally take that into consideration with regards to what these other different groups are trying to do. And there were groups from, like, the West Coast that were coming in and wanting to get arrested and wanting to do things. And, you know, and that's their thing. But I just felt like it wasn't really fair to kind of make that thing happen since the police weren't the people we were fighting. You know, I don't know. That's kind of a tangent, but...
Well, that, I mean, it does lead to one and actually two more specifics about communication. I know it's probably all sort of conflated in your memory, and you've done posts on your Facebook page for months now, but I'm wondering if you could either give an example of one type of post, or maybe what are the sort of things that you do on your Facebook page to help, you know, either at the time while the protests were going or now to help keep spreading the word about this.
Oh, well, a lot of the posts that I do will be news coverage of the different things. So I always made sure that, like when the New York Times was covering it and stuff, to just have specific topical, you know, this is how it's being portrayed right now in the media. This is what they're saying about us right now. You know, Reuters, The Guardian, all these different news sources that had their things out there. I also would make sure to post things like editorial letters that I saw around that were related to the topics. And also to make sure to post things that were events. And so that people would know what's going on right now, you know, what you can do here. I mean, like, in the beginning when the whole budget bill first got started and there was all these really horrible hearings about, like, expanding charter schools and stuff, it was like, oh, quick, I got to press a button and send that out. Because, you know, if somebody here in Madison cares about this and wants to make it to the hearing, then they can do that, you know. And so I really think just having a wide variety of information out there. And then, too, as the pages spread and as things started really heating up in Ohio and Florida and Michigan, it's been really important to me to be like, this isn't just us, you know, this is totally happening across the country and we really need to stop and squelch it now. And so I've made sure to have news items about the other people, the other states that this is going down in, and different events for them. Like, I mean, there's been times when people have told me about, oh, there's gonna be a hearing in Iowa in 3 days or whatever, and so I'll post that. It's like, hey, Iowa, heads up, they're starting it over there now. So yeah, a lot of the things that I'll have will be things like that. And then some of the stuff I do too is cheerleading, because I'm not like the cheerleader type, and if you knew me in high school, I would be the goth kid over in the, you know, black flannel or whatever,
But it's really important to kind of celebrate, if not even a victory, at least a stalemate. Because, I mean, right now they're just taking so much away and they're just fighting so hard that it just seems to me that if there's any way that you can just stopping it for a minute, you know, that's worth stopping and cheering and being like, hey, you know. So I'll post things like songs and stuff too, just to be like, we're keeping on.
And this leads me to the larger question. I haven't thought about it this much. It isn't specifically on here. Mm-hmm. But we talked about Governor Walker possibly being a bit naive about what was going to happen. But also this protest happens in an age where there's social media.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you've thought about, you know, having a background, not necessarily in history, but in folklore and studying culture, if you've thought about how important, I use that word, that social media is to be able to
keep this thing going.
What's going on?
You know, the day of the Joint Finance Committee hearings on February 15th, I was sitting in the room next to a guy for a while who's a teacher in Monona, and he was waiting to speak too. And we were kind of, there was a point where there was nothing going on, and so people were allowed to whisper to each other very quietly without getting kicked out of the room. And so the guy and I were whispering about getting some information out there and how we wished that, you know, we were like, I wish I had my laptop right now so I could Facebook this. And, you know, and he was like, he told me that he had a page for the Monona Grove Education Association. And I told him about the page that I had started, or the event that I had started. And so we traded the names of those things, and we're going to like each other on the Facebook. And he was like, you know, if we're going to win this, this is one of the ways that we're going to do it. This will be one of the prime tools that we do this with, is the internet. And I mean, I think that we've had a lot of inspiration not to compare ourselves with the things that go on in places like Iran and Egypt, but, you know, they use social media very effectively there. They use it very effectively there when they can, you know, when it's not being cut off and stuff. And so, I mean, we were seeing stuff like that happen around the world anyway, and we knew doing that anyway. I mean, people Facebook about the most mundane things. It was like, of course we're going to be out there using Twitter, Facebook, email, whatever, to get this thing. And so, when like the Wi-Fi was cut off from us at the Capitol, and then the TA put in their own Wi-Fi, and then somebody was busting in and making it so you couldn't go to the Defend Wisconsin website and stuff like that, I mean, they knew that, you know, they were using, well, illegally what what they could to stop us, but it still wasn't stopping us. Because it's like, oh, I can step 5 feet outside the Capitol and use my cell phone to send this off. You know, we're not idiots. We're going to do whatever we can to fight this, because this is, you know, it's the battleground. It happened. So, yeah, I mean, I've thought about that a lot. I mean, that's why when this first started, Tim was like, hey, here's a couple of PDFs you might be interested in. You know, it's like, well, yeah, I'm going to put that on the internet. Everybody can see that. It's a public message.
We're getting close to unfortunately, my time for today to wrap up. I'll ask this question, and since we'll have a follow-up, I may ask this question again because it may change.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, as we've been talking and as you've been retelling this, is there a strong memory or memory that stands out in your mind, particularly of the heat of this, which was starting February 14th,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, February 11th, as you say, with the emails that came out, through really when Judge Sumi, I think, in my mind, the injunction to a certain extent sort of rolled it back a little bit. I mean,
yeah.
At least in terms of people going. So anyway, that's sort of
mm-hmm.
my timeline. But
yeah.
It could be a strong memory of something that just happened a couple of days ago involving.
Well, you know, I mean, there's so many, because I took my kids to so many of the marches after that, and I mean, I would try to stop by at least for a little bit to do things. This is just a cheesy anecdote that I'll tell you about, but since my husband's been too sick, and one of the medications that he's on this year gives him he can get easily frustrated and kind of angry, and so he, even though he could physically go to the protest, didn't want to in case he got angry, and who's like, I don't want to get arrested for whatever, you know, and I was like, okay, that's cool. So the day after they illegally signed the bill and let everybody into the Capitol again, you know, they broke the open meetings law. I think that was March 10th was the day after. I had been there March 9th when it happened. And so March 10th in the morning, I came back up. And that was when Joe Parisi and Jesse Jackson were stuck outside and couldn't get in. And so we got into the building later. And so I was standing there in the building, and I'm just like, I just had this kind of moment where I was like, I'm not defeated, I'm not giving up, but I'm just going to be sad for a minute. So I was just kind of standing there being sad, and all of a sudden, like, Jesse Jackson comes wheeling around the corner with a couple of his guys that work with him, and he looked at me, he like walks right up to me, and I was like, thanks for coming to these, we really appreciate you being here and getting this message out to other people. And he was like, you look like you could use a hug. And so he gave me a hug, and then he's like, why don't you come be on Fox News with me? I'm about to be interviewed right now. And so I was just like, okay, that's cool, you know, whatever. And so we started walking over to the cameras, but he had the orange t-shirts that the assembly members wore, the Wisconsin Democrats working for families t-shirt. And so he was like, here, hold this up. And so I was going to stand next to him, hold the t-shirt, but then it was so crowded right there because we were standing on one of those kind of bridge things up on the second level and or the third level. And so there's this lady who was doing deaf interpreting for people below, and so I let her kind of stand in my place and so that she could get the message out. And so I kind of stood back there, and I had this t-shirt and stuff, and I was just kind of, you know. So he got done with, I guess he did two interviews with Fox News, and then there was just so many people, and I was kind of getting claustrophobic, and I didn't like standing on that bridge and stuff, and so I kind of kept scooting back, but I still got this t-shirt in my hand. And then, like, when he was done, he just walked off in the other direction, and so I'm just left with this t-shirt. I'm like, man, this is, you know, my daughter had broken the camera 2 weeks before these protests began. And so, like, I didn't have a camera. I had no proof of this. But here I'm standing with this t-shirt that Jesse Jackson just gave me. So I went home that night and or that afternoon. And my husband had had a bad day. I guess he was out in the garage and, like, he dropped a hammer on his leg or something. And he was just like, you know, my table I'm working on didn't get fixed. And so he was just kind of stopping and taking a break. And he was like, it's been a bad day for me. And I was like, well, it's been a bad day for Wisconsin, but if it's any consolation, Jesse Jackson gave me a t-shirt. And so, you know, it was a t-shirt made for a large man. And so I was just like, well, here, Stuart, you know, this is your souvenir of the Wisconsin protests. So now he wears it sometimes. And, it, you know, it's a cheesy, it has no real point or anything. But it was just like one of those kind of apocryphal stories that I can't prove. I don't really need to prove because it's just like whatever. But, yeah, I won't let my husband. I saw him painting in that shirt one time and I was like, you get that off right now. What are you doing?
Any other thing you want to feel you need to get off your chest today? Understanding, of course, that we'll try to meet one more time.
Just that I'm glad that this happened. I mean, one of the things that I've been able to record are the things that are going on now in Upper Michigan, where I'm about to live, and the recall movement to get rid of their Governor Rick Snyder. And so it's been really gratifying to see people that I thought wouldn't stand up against this actually standing up and doing things. And, like, they've had really small rallies, of course. It's the county where I'm from only has 36,000 people, like, the whole county. And so, but, you know, they've been getting out there, and they've been saying, hey, we're not going to do this. And with their recall petitions and stuff, I've heard they had a recall event when it first started up in Marquette, Michigan, which is the biggest town up there, and it still only has, like, 25,000 people in the whole town. And over a four-hour period, they collected 400 signatures in a town of 25,000 people. You know, and so it's just really gratifying to see this sort of sweeping nationwide and to see all the different rallies that have taken up in different places and to see people doing stuff on behalf of Wisconsin. You know, if Scott Walker leaves the state and we know about it, somebody in New York's going to do something for us if he shows up there. And they did, you know, so it's a fight they want, it's a fight they get. And we're all going to be here to take part in it.
All right. Well, Hillary, thank you very much for meeting me here. And this ends this interview.